We've drawn a line in the sand. You can ask me about background, you can ask me about personal issues, I'm not going to answer. I'm not.
Republican Senate candidate Joe Miller says he's done talking to Alaska Press about his record. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 11th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state's game board takes another stab at a community hunt.
Mr. Chairman, I am ready to vote on this. I think we've beat it to death enough.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
It was a day of waiting for the Alaska Press Corps in Anchorage. The campaign for Joe Miller had originally scheduled a press conference with Miller for 11 a.m. today, but it was canceled and rescheduled to follow the Senate candidate debate sponsored by the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce at noon. All three candidates, Republican primary winner Joe Miller, write-in candidate Senator Lisa Murkowski, and the Democrat nominee Scott McAdams were present and fielded questions from the moderator, from each other, and from the audience. But the main story came after the conclusion of the debates. Fox News personality Greta Van Susteren was granted an interview with Joe Miller, and although the Alaska Press Corps was present, a question from an Anchorage Daily News reporter was brushed off. After Van Susteren concluded her questioning of Miller, the press corps waited, and finally Mr. Miller approached a microphone to assail the press for an alleged leak of information out of his personnel file from the time he was employed as an attorney with the Fairbanks Borough. Miller said it was illegal.
It is an outrageous breach of my family's privacy. This is just the latest political attack, an attack that's based upon avoiding the issues, where we're at as a state, where we're at as a nation, and looking at other things that basically distract people's attention.
Miller said it highlights what he sees as viciousness in the campaign.
You know, Kathleen and I are probably the most disclosed couple in Alaskan politics, at least in recent history. You know virtually everything about us. You know, whether it's her background, whether it's my background. And most of those things that have come out, or at least many of them, I shouldn't say most, arise out of leaks, you know, whether it be medical information, HIPAA violations. These things are violations of the law. They're invasions of privacy that really do not bring the state forward in the dialogue.
Miller has not held elected office before, and scrutiny has increased as information has surfaced that some of the federal programs he has denounced have in the past benefited his family. His wife received unemployment benefits. Miller has called them unconstitutional. They applied for and received low-income hunting and fishing license when they first moved to the state. And his children benefited from Denali KidCare, the low-income state-run health program that includes federal Medicaid money. Miller has criticized his opponent, Senator Lisa Murkowski, for supporting Denali KidCare because funds can be used for abortions. Miller was also 7 months late in filing his required Senate candidate financial disclosure forms. Miller's opponents have accused him and his Tea Party Express supporters of setting a negative tone in the race, but Miller told the press today the campaign has been hard on him.
This commitment that I have, not just to the state, but to the nation, it's been extremely difficult on our family, extraordinarily difficult. My children miss me. My wife misses me. She's here with me now. She's withstood a lot of the scrutiny as well. But we're fighting for everyone, not just my kids.
He then told the press that he was making a new commitment today.
We've drawn a line in the sand. You can ask me about background. You can ask me about personal issues. I'm not going to answer. I'm not. This is about the issues. This is not about continuing the personal attacks. It's not about continuing the diversions based in illegal acts. This is about moving the state forward. And that's our commitment.
Candidate Miller then stepped away from the microphone, refusing any questions from the Alaska press, as did his campaign spokesman, Randy DeSoto. Alaska's Game Board has given the green light to a community hunt to start in 2011, despite grumblings from the state. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The Board of Games session in Anchorage was comparatively quiet this morning after a weekend of heated public testimony. Panel members discussed a proposal before them to create a three-level Nelchina caribou hunt to address court concerns about last year's Otna community harvest. That hunt was deemed illegal earlier this year in answer to a court challenge. Now the job before the board is to ensure reasonable harvest opportunity for eligible permit holders while addressing the court's concerns about the constitutionality of residency-based community hunting programs. The State Department of Law's Kevin Saxby told the board that the panel can issue a community harvest program, it just can't be residency-based. And once an area is designated as a community hunt area, any group can apply for a permit. The new plan creates a community hunt with an allocation of 300 caribou in the area previously deemed the Otna 8 community area. Fish and Game area biologist Bruce Dale said the season will close by emergency order when the allocation is taken.
On the other hand, there's a potential for hundreds and hundreds of small groups to, groups of two or three people to come in and create a very huge administrative burden for the department just in administering that many permits and having that many group representatives to deal. And so one of the other things that this does is put a minimum size on the group for two reasons. First of all, this is designed to be a community-based or communal experience, and so the board is entitled to ensure that it really is a communal experience and not just two hunting buddies together.
Dale said any group that applies must comply with a subsistence pattern of use. Board Chair Cliff Judkins said he was uncomfortable with a lack of details about the plan for the new hunting regime, which creates two Tier 1 hunts along with the new community hunt plan.
Well, my concern is we've been through this before and we went ahead and approved things without really seeing this detail. We got our fanny slapped in court. And I'm not prepared to do that again. I'd like to see this stuff laid out here and the ABC's fine, and I'd like it so the average person can read it and understand it and know where he sits before we walk down that path again. I'm just not interested in doing that. So.
Board member Teresa Alba sided with Judkins on concerns about a lack of details, saying that the new program is flawed because although any group can apply for a community permit, the permit is tied to an Otna customary and traditional subsistence use pattern. However, the proposal passed with a 4-2-3 vote. The Department of Fish and Game's Dave Rabe said the new hunting regime has three components: a community harvest group of 25 members or more, a Tier 1 individual registration hunt, and a third drawing hunt. Rabe said the department is caught in a time constraint because of public notification requirements concerning next year's hunting opportunities. Otna's Nick Jackson said the decision is the best the Otna natives can get right now. It's not completely what we want, he said, but it is a start. Otna is in the process of appealing the Superior Court decision outlawing this year's Otna community hunt. Early Sunday, Attorney General Dan Sullivan contacted the board requesting the panel table the community hunt question until after a state Supreme Court decision on the matter. The board refused that request. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The president and CEO of one of the state's largest Native corporations was terminated yesterday amid a sexual harassment lawsuit. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
Calista, the regional corporation for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, fired Matthew Nicolai following a 15-year stint as president. Nicolai had been with the corporation for 35 years altogether. In 2009, he was paid over $730,000 as the president. The board of directors made their decision in a special meeting held Sunday. Nicolai had been on administrative leave starting August 31st, following sexual harassment allegations by an employee. The person alleges that they had an affair, and he later became a stalker and prevented her from doing her job. On Sunday, the board of directors decided to terminate Nicolai.
This has nothing to do with the business of Schuster Corporation.
Lincoln Garrick is a corporation spokesperson. He says the board had conducted an independent investigation into human resources violations involving Nicolai.
And the independent investigators presented results and findings on Friday. And the board took those into account and unanimously decided to terminate the employment contract of Matthew Nicolai.
In the same meeting, the board unanimously supported hiring Acting President Andrew Guy as Nikolai's permanent replacement. Guy has been with Calista since 1996 as General Counsel and Executive Vice President. Calista is the second largest Native corporation in the state. Its region includes over 13,000 shareholders and 6.5 million acres of land. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking at Arctic drilling and the need for more information.
Most of our modern understanding of oil and ice comes actually from those experiments done in the 70s.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Hello, I'm Peter Kenyon, NPR foreign correspondent and former APRN reporter. Help support APRN's news mission by joining me on October 24th for the first of the new APRN speaker series. Go to APRN.org to reserve your ticket today.
A husband and wife living in Ketchikan are the new presidents of Southeast Alaska's oldest Native organizations. Richard and Janice Jackson were elected to head up the grand camps of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood. The Jacksons were elected during the organization's grand camp convention held last week in Saxman near Ketchikan. Richard Jackson takes over the post from Willard Jackson of Ketchikan. Janice Jackson succeeds Michaelyn Coons McGee of Juneau. The Grand Camp is the umbrella organization for the ANB and ANS local chapters, which are also called camps. ANB was founded in 1912 and was a key organization in land claims fights that resulted in passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The groups represent mostly Southeast Alaskans, but there have been chapters in Anchorage, Seattle, and California. This year, the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean retreated, opening up routes for shipping along almost its entire coast. That could lead to less expensive offshore oil development in the Arctic and shorter, cheaper shipping routes. In this first of a two-part series, Johanna Urich looks at the safety of oil production in icy waters.
The crude oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico has underscored the difficulty of controlling or cleaning up any spill. But it is tougher in the Arctic because of sea ice, and scientists do not have a clear handle on how tough it would be. A lot of the discussion cites the work done in the 70s. It was then that Peter Wadhams did his postdoctoral work, pouring oil under the ice along Canada's coast. In broken ice, he found that the oil piled up on pressure ridges, but it was a different story when it was spilled underneath flat ice.
Put a rubber boom around it, and then deliberately covered the bottom of the ice with oil to see what happened, and in fact found that new ice grew underneath the oil and made a sort of oil sandwich.
Of course, all that would change once the ice melted.
After that, it was no longer allowed to spill oil, so you couldn't really study an oil spill in ice because you couldn't do one. So most of our modern understanding of oil in ice comes actually from those experiments done in the 70s.
Engineers who design oil rigs to operate in the Arctic say that cleaning up a spill in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas would be easier than controlling a blowout in the Gulf of Mexico because the Arctic Ocean is much shallower. There, rigs would be operating on an ocean floor 100 to 150 as opposed to 5,000 feet down. But the best is to keep accidents from happening, and that's where a person like Arno Kananen comes in. Originally from Finland, he spent half of his long career working with state-of-the-art icebreakers, and the last 30 years working with the offshore oil industry. He manages ice by working with groups of icebreakers to break up the ice and keep big icebergs from hitting oil rigs. He did this in the Sakhalin oil field off the Russian coast. He says the reason much of the offshore Arctic development has occurred safely is because the equipment has worked much better than predicted.
The track record is that the operational performance in ice has been systematically exceeded, not only slightly, but with a big margin. The systems have been capable of much more than they were thought. So it shows that actually the designers and planners or operators have been conservative. So far, anyways.
But Kananen says that anyone operating in the Arctic has to understand it is all pioneering work and difficult, if not impossible, to regulate.
In today's world, every single ICE offshore operation is a pioneering operation. You don't go there with assuming that you know everything and just start and operate and nothing is going to be surprising you. It's possible to make sure that there's layers of safety built into the system. What is how safe? To me, this is one of the essential things about the success of the Arctic future, is that no oil company should be allowed to take risks which can spoil the whole future of the Arctic operation for everybody.
In Alaska, many say the risk is too big. National environmental groups have made a battleground political issue out of it. They point to the lack of icebreakers. Of the three owned by the U.S. Coast Guard, two are so old they spend most of their time in dry dock getting repairs. And one is a research vessel, not the kind of working ships that routinely ply icy Russian waters. Walt Parker, a U.S. delegate to the Arctic Council and longtime Alaskan, spent most of a week recently listening to the best Arctic marine architects and engineers from around the world talking about their latest research and designs. He sees no real advance in spill response in over 20 years.
You know, if the United States wants to commit to going to get that 23 billion barrels of oil that are in the Chukchi and the Beaufort, why, they'd better start spending some money on research and start spending some money on support equipment like icebreakers and make sure the industry does it, one of the two. I still haven't seen any real response out of the administration on the lack of research that I pointed out in 09.
Parker says there's no indication that Congress is committed to building more icebreakers. The risks that opponents of offshore oil drilling speak of rarely include the risk posed by the annual spring runoff to offshore Arctic pipelines. It's called strudel scour. David Dickens with Chevron's Arctic Center in Calgary has just made a 13-year database mapping strudel scours along the coast from a bay near Point Barrow to Kaktovik.
And so these pipelines are vulnerable in shallow water to these features called strudel, where you only have to imagine drainage in your own bathtub and watching the water go down, magnify that 1,000 times, and you've got a strudel scour. And you think of the water being maybe 10 or 15 feet deep, and the drainage is so violent even that it reaches right down to the bottom, to the seabed, and it gouges out a pit in the bottom, in the mud. And some of these pits can be over 10 feet deep. So if you have a pipeline running through there, of course, people have to be concerned about it, because it could actually, the fill that goes in the trench after the pipeline is buried could be dug away by these strudel scours.
These scours will become more of a major issue as pipelines reach out to offshore gravel islands housing drilling operations. It's not possible to bury the pipes deep enough to escape scouring, so oil companies have to go out every spring and check on the pipe, reburying and maintaining it as needed. Some hope that the problem will disappear as more ice melts in the coming decades, opening up the possibility of increased shipping in the Arctic. More on this tomorrow. I'm Johanna Urich.
A consent agreement between the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and the City of Anchorage and three other entities was reached last week in a hazardous waste case in the city's Kincaid Park. The city, Kincaid Project Group, Land Design North, and Roger Hickel Contracting have agreed to complete the cleanup of lead-contaminated soil at Kincaid and must submit a cleanup plan to EPA within 90 days. Kevin Shanilak is an EPA compliance officer.
It stems from construction activities that happened in 2008, where an old firing range was being converted into a soccer field. The construction started without first verifying how much lead contamination was on the site.
According to the EPA, contractors for the soccer field moved lead-contaminated soil from the site of a shooting range which operated in the park between 1988 and 2007. The construction generated approximately 30 tons of lead-contaminated hazardous waste soil and debris. The EPA says the material was disposed of on-site without treatment or proper testing. The EPA charges the shooting range was contaminated with lead from bullets, with lead soils levels ranging as high as 68 1,000 parts per million. Lead contamination was disturbed and spread over approximately 4 acres without prior testing to determine whether the lead levels would be classified as hazardous waste. Shanilac says the State Department of Environmental Conservation alerted the EPA to the fact that construction was underway without determining the level of contamination.
We've been working with the City of Anchorage and the other parties involved since that time to get a cleanup plan in place. These things take time, and what today's consent agreement means is that the cleanup process will now happen within a definite time frame.
Under the settlement, the parties agreed to pay a penalty of more than $63,000 for violations of federal hazardous waste management rules, also known as Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. Peter Van Tine, an attorney representing the Kincaid Project Group, says the group is committed to the cleanup under today's settlement. Van Tine says it will be some time before a final decision is made on who pays the additional costs of cleanup and waste removal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
John Stein is no stranger to close elections. When he became mayor of Wasilla in 1987, he won by just 19 votes. But his race to be Sitka's next mayor is even closer. A count today of 560 absentee ballots brought Stein to within a single vote of Cheryl Westover. As KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, the results truly won't be known until Tuesday night.
That was the reaction from onlookers as absentee ballots were counted on Monday morning in Sitka's municipal election. Cheryl Westover is ahead in the race for mayor over John Stein. A week ago, on election night, John Stein trailed Cheryl Westover by 60 votes. As of Monday afternoon, Stein was down by a single vote.
Yikes. That's about as close as you can get. I didn't really expect it would be a one-vote thing.
Municipal Clerk Colleen Ingman's office is conducting a recount of all precincts, given the tight margin in the final tally. More absentee ballots could arrive on Tuesday. If the ballots are postmarked on or before October 5th, they count. Monday was a holiday for the U.S. Post Office, so no mail was delivered.
In this case, those could really make a difference. So I'll be waiting.
While Stein is waiting to see if he has to show up at Tuesday night's assembly meeting when new electees will be sworn in, Cheryl Westover knows she'll have to be there. She's a current assembly member.
Well, I knew it'd be a tight race, and either way, I'm still there, and I just want to thank the people for getting out and voting the way they did in general, and it'll be what it'll be.
If Westover is not elected, she'll continue on the assembly with her term expiring in 2012. Her election as mayor would create a vacancy on the assembly. There's no requirement for assembly members to appoint the next highest vote-getter, but that has been a practice in the past. The next highest vote-getter in the assembly race would be Jack Osmond, the incumbent, who handed Ingman a letter on Monday afternoon formally requesting to be considered for that position. The cutoff point for vote counting will be Tuesday night's assembly meeting when the current members of the assembly are scheduled to certify the results. That certification comes before the new members are sworn in. While the absentee ballot numbers made slight changes to other items in the municipal election, there were no significant changes to the margins in those other races. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Pelican officials hope their takeover of a closed seafood plant will help invigorate the town's economy, but they've got a long way to go before that happens. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Pelican Mayor Patricia Phillips says the seafood plant owed the city about $40,000 in taxes, and there seemed to be no chance that the owner, Ed Barden Associates, would reopen or pay. So the city went to court and won a foreclosure ruling that left the municipal government Pelican Seafood's owner. Phillips says she hopes the city can win grants to get part of the 60-year-old plant going again.
The ice machine there can be rebuilt, and a refrigeration system could be hooked up to the ice machines and the ice bins to, you know, get that ice machine going again, to get the fleet in here.
She would like to see the facility's laundromat reopened, which she says would also attract fishermen. Pelican is 80 miles north of Sitka and 70 miles west of Juneau. It's built on the shores of Lisianski Inlet on the northwest coast of Chichagof Island. In its heyday, the seafood plant was the town's largest employer and processed up to 6 million pounds of fish a year. But changing economic trends meant it struggled through several owners, and the deteriorating plant was rarely open in recent times. The situation reached crisis stage in 2009 when a hydroelectric system breakdown threatened to shut off power to the closed cold storage facility. Some feared the frozen, rotten wooden structure would collapse when thawed, releasing dangerous amounts of ammonia, but government officials stepped in and resolved the situation.
The Pelican plant has been decommissioned to an extent, and so all the anhydrous ammonia has been pulled out of the piping system in the plant.
Sarah Moore works for the State Department of Environmental Conservation's Division of Spill Prevention and Response.
It's all being stored in the high and low pressure receiver of the system. As the situation stands now and all the information that the state has, it is not an imminent threat to the community.
The building remains in poor condition, and Mayor Phillips says power is too expensive to resume operations, even if repairs are made. But the city's applying for about $2 million in state and federal grants in hopes of increasing hydroelectric capacity. Phillips says potential seafood plant buyers have shied away because of its financial entanglements. She hopes the city's takeover and the potential for reduced power costs could bring them back.
In my opinion, there's hope for, you know, some sort of operation in there, not to the glory days of what we once were, but we are so strategically located, you know, close to Cross Sound, and we're hopeful that someone will, you know, consider what we got here and maybe take a closer look and put some sort of operation in here.
The most recent owner, Ed Barden Associates, has not been available for interviews, and the CEO of the previous owner, Cake Tribal Corporation, could not be reached for immediate comment. The corporation has said it was not fully paid and hoped to take action to retrieve some of the property's value. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Johanna Urich in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.